Okay, well, I'm just going to introduce the evening. I'm Tony Travers from the Government Department, British Government of LSE, an initiative that embraces study of government politics, policy throughout the school. We're having a series of lectures, of which this is the third or fourth, colleagues inside the school to talk about their research, particularly as it affects or influences government and policy, impact and all of that. And this evening our speaker is Professor Julian Legrand, who is the Richard Titmuss Professor in the Social Policy Department and as impactful an academic as there is in the London School of Economics and Political Science. Julian, he's going to talk about nudge theory and then any state.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you everybody for coming. I apologise to those of you who have heard something before. Some of you and some familiar faces in the audience, and they've really heard the jokes as well. They're still laughable. This all really came about. I was lucky enough to work in government for a while. I worked at Number 10 Downing Street and Tony Blair, not a cube of booze. On the second day of my appointment there, as an advisor, I got into a row with the Secretary of State for Health, which is probably not a good career move, actually, but nonetheless. The Secretary of State for Health was John Reeve at the time, and it was about banning smoking in public places. I'd actually managed to get the Prime Minister to sign up to the idea of banning smoking in public places, at least nominally. Tony Blair wasn't actually quite keen on banning things, so it was actually quite an achievement, I thought, to get this. But John Reed was very opposed to it. He'd been a 50-a-day smoker himself at one point, and his mother had been a 50-a-day smoker. His mother said on her deathbed, dying of lung cancer, I may say, she said, "John, for God's sake, don't let them ban smoking." So he was opposed to too much restrictions on smoking. I was one of the reasons why I've been brought in to work in London was to work on the policies of choice, particularly patient choice of hospital and choice of parental choice of school. And he said, "Well, look, you're an advocate of choice and the freedom of choice. How can you really justify this kind of restriction upon people's freedom that you're proposing? I mean, what would be wrong, for example," he said, "in having a room in every pub or every restaurant into which everybody went, every smoker went, they carried their own food and stuff, no staff went into it. The evidence on passive smoking is actually pretty weak, but except for bar staff it is pretty strong for that. And what would be wrong with just having this room which everyone can go into?" And that's a difficult question to answer. In the end, I had to sort of say, "Well, I'm really, I suppose, a paternalist. I actually think it would be good for them not to have this room available. It would be good for smokers to stop smoking." So he said, "Well, so you really believe the state should save people from themselves? Even if you have there's no third party being harmed, so the state should save people from themselves." And I said, "Well, yes, I suppose I did. I do. Under certain circumstances." And he said, "What circumstances?" And I said, "Well, really, I suppose I spent the remaining 5 or 6 years since then trying to work out exactly what circumstances I believe that. And you'll be getting some of the benefits of that today." The questions I really want to address are the questions of paternalism. Should the state intervene to save people from themselves? And if we agree that they should or they could, How should they do so? And I wanted to talk particularly about the whole nudge agenda, the agenda liberal, so-called libertarian paternalism, as one way of doing it, and compare that indeed with what you might think of as the nanny state, which is when you regulate people, like indeed banning smoking in public places, or in some ways you compel people not to engage in the healthy harming activities or any other kind of activities that will harm themselves. Okay, I must say it's a sensitive area. This is a postcard I received when I was involved in this debate about banning smoking in public places. You can't see it very well, but I don't know. I think you might be able to read that one. It's an invitation.
Could you perhaps turn half the lights off?
Yeah. Can we just turn
the front?
It's a slow acting one.
There is a very active lobby, that of freedom of action. It isn't just a lobby, it does tap into a real fear that people have about people's a reluctance to endorse the state intervening in these kind of ways to try and deal with it. Let's just think a little bit about what we mean by paternalism, first of all, because that's quite important. The simplest definition is one that says, basically, that violates John Stuart Mill's Harm Principle. Here's his Harm Principle: the only purpose for which power may be rightfully exercised over any member of the civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others. His own good is not sufficient. This is John Stuart Mill's view. And I suppose a paternalistic policy, one definition is simply that it interferes with the person's freedom for their own good. That's what we mean by it. Various philosophers have looked at this, and we have the question of paternalism is interfering, a more sophisticated definition, interference with a person's liberty of action, justifiable reasons referring to exclusively to the welfare, etc., of the person being coerced. The trouble is that it's not clear that it really does capture fully what we mean by paternalism. There are various forms of actions that I think most of us would think are paternalistic in form. It's hard to really argue that they're really infringing on people's liberty of action. For example, we subsidise the arts, we subsidise opera, e.g., or we provide museums for free. There are lots of reasons why we do that, but one of the reasons is almost certainly some kind of paternalistic reason, some kind of reason that we want to in some sense allow people to improve themselves, and we want to encourage people to improve themselves, and we do that via some form of subsidy. And of course the whole nudge agenda, many of the nudge ideas, the classic one, which is about opting in and opting out of pensions, we'll talk about this a bit later on, but where if you switch from a system in which people have to opt in to a pension to a system where people are automatically enrolled in a pension but then have to opt out, you get massive changes in behaviour, with people, many poor people staying in the pension scheme under the second scheme than under the first. But I think it's hard to describe the switch of the default, so to speak, from an opt-in to an opt-out, as in some sense coercing people or interfering with their liberty of action. I mean, in fact, the liberty of action, the freedom, the choices are exactly the same in both cases. But we'll come back to that later on. And I think it is quite hard to define paternalism purely in terms of coercion. Thaler and Sunstein, as you will know, Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein are the origins of the nudge book, that wrote the nudge book, and indeed wrote one of the key articles that started it all off. They defined paternalism to try to allow for freedom of choice. But again, we don't find that altogether satisfactory. It includes, for example, the simple provision of information. And I think most people would think that's a way of correcting market failure, is providing people with information. But I don't think providing information as such is necessarily paternalistic, although, as we might discuss later on, there may be ways of doing it that are more or less paternalistic than others. And there are other questions, like how we decide or how make people better off as judged by themselves. The definition that we came to, I say we because I'm writing a book with Bill New. Bill New is an ex-PhD student of mine. The definition that we came to, in the end, refers to intention. That you probably can't define paternalism without referring in some way to the intention of the state, what the state is trying to do. And so here we're saying the state intervention is paternalistic if it's intended to address what is, in the state's view, a failure of judgment by the individual, and it is intended to further the individual's own good. And so that's the kind of definition with which we'll be working with as we go through deal with libertarianism. Now, it's worth having a little bit of thought. Okay, so if we've got that definition broadly under our belts, now let's think a bit about, well, what are the how can we justify paternalism? How can we take what I might call the John Reed challenge? How should the state save people themselves, or what possible reasons could you have? Well, one might be that it hurts third parties, but of course that isn't really paternalism. I mean, even John Stuart Mill would agree that it's legitimate for the state to intervene if some sort of third party is involved. The test is when passive smoking being the classic case. Cost to the state is another one, a very common argument put forward for justifying particularly intervention in health matters is saving people, saving the National Health Service costs. And it's a slightly dodgy argument, actually, and it takes you in somewhat uncomfortable directions. There's quite an interesting study in Holland of healthy patients versus unhealthy patients, and indicating that healthy patients cost the health service much more than unhealthy ones do. And indeed, of course, if one takes something like smoking, I don't want to be too insensitive here, but smoking does tend to kill people from lung cancer. Lung cancer kills people around the age of 65 before they can draw their pension. So on the whole, probably if you're going down this particular route, you would justify encouraging smoking rather than taking it forward. But it isn't really paternalism if it is the third party involved. Another form might be what might call failure of autonomy. The John Reed challenge really refers to autonomous individuals, to individuals individuals who are perfectly capable of agency, perfectly capable of undertaking their own actions, and yet nonetheless we still justify paternalistic interventions to stop them doing what they want to do. For there might well be obviously categories of people who we regard as not autonomous in that sense, and again it's probably not paternalistic. I mean, children of course is the classic case, but we might have some people with who are physically incapable of making decisions. I mean, somebody unconscious in a hospital bed, for example, and it might be there might be mental illness problems of various kinds that you might think means that this individual is not a fully autonomous individual. And once we get to that, then it's probably then interventions can be. However. The challenge is really, are there reasons why the state would be justified in intervening in fully autonomous individuals' decisions? And here I think it's useful to distinguish between two things, between means and ends. means and ends concerning the ends are the things that give value to our lives. It's our health, maybe, our well-being, or in a broad sense, our sense of well-being, the reasons why, in the sense of the reasons why we have for living, the good life, our definition of the good life, the end. And the means are our activity, the activities we undertake to achieve those ends. Now, this isn't a hard and fast distinction, and probably, if we have, hopefully we'll have the time for this discussion, people will probably raise this, but the state can take a view about both means and ends. It could take the view that that it disapproves of the ends that people have. It does not like people. Certain people have certain conceptions of the good life. It does not like that. Their conception of the good life. It might regard them as morally corrupting in some way or other. And so it disapproves of those ends, and in that case it intervenes to prevent people making those ends. Or it could say, well, we don't care what people do, what people want to do, we don't care about their ends, apparently everyone should be free to have their own conception of the good life and do what they provide, they don't hurt anybody else, of course, in getting there, but they should have their own conception of the good life. However, they might well make mistakes of judgment, in the state's view, in getting there. They might make mistakes on the way, getting there. So they might want a really healthy life, but they fail to give up smoking. Although they fully intend to give up smoking, they want to give up smoking, but for one reason or another, they fail to do so. I think it's very difficult to, it's certainly very difficult for a liberal in the broadest sense, I think, to defend ends failure or to defend state intervention based on ends failure. I think you have to, it's just a different view of the world which says that I, meaning the state, has a conception of what people ought to be doing, and I'm going to, and if people don't, but what people ought to want, and if they don't want it, I'm going to make sure they do, or I'm going to stop them wanting the things they, stop them getting the things they do want. Basically, we rule out the idea of a justification based on ends failure. Means failure, on the other hand, or what we might call reasoning failure, we think there is a case for. That's ends failure, where the state disapproves of the ends that individuals themselves have voluntarily chosen, and some examples given there of the various kinds of ends that people might disapprove of. Reasoning failure, well, when one looks at reasoning failure, one then gets into the territory of behavioural economics, behavioural economics and behavioural psychology, I won't go through these in great detail, but I think we can identify four areas of reasoning failure. One is for limited technical ability. There are all limitations on people's ability to reason. A failure to process information properly, decision overload, too many choices. I have to say one of the things, as an advocate of choice in other contexts, like hospitals and schools, I do get frequently attacked by people who say that if you have too many choices, it gets in the way. There's lots of psychological evidence to suggest that, it does create problems, too many choices. Limited imagination experience. Those of you who've looked at some behavioural economics or behavioural psychology will recognise some of these phrases. Status quo bias, where you're in favour of the status quo, because you can't imagine what it would be like not to be in the status quo. Downward effect, where you value losses as greater than gains, even if the nominal value of the gains and losses are the same. And myopia, short-sightedness, which I must say I think is probably the most important of all failure. The difficulty that an 18-year-old who's picking up a cigarette or eating a hamburger has to imagine what it must be like to be 65 years old with heart disease or with lung cancer, and that gap the inability to put yourself in the place of the 80 or the 60-year-olds or whatever does seem to be one of the absolute major causes of what you might term reasoning failure. This will be familiar to everybody: limited willpower, procrastination. Some people regard that addiction as a form of that. Aristotle's term, akrasia, meaning a freedom, inability to exercise one's will, even though you know you want to give up smoking, you know you've got to get that article in by tomorrow, and you still delay, you still don't, you have this other cigarette, you say, oh, well, I'll get up in the morning to write the article, and so on. And then limited objectivity, the fact that even if you had got all the information available and all, and you know, information often carries baggage with it of various kinds, emotional commitment with it of various kinds, and you'll get stuck with a kind of, and it overwhelms your objectivity and your capacity. So all of these are areas of reasoning failure. I hope you'll notice that I haven't adopted terms like rationality or irrationality, which I don't think actually help this discussion, but they're all areas where individuals make judgments that damage their lifetime utility or their lifetime happiness or their lifetime well-being or the ends that they want to achieve, and where the state can intervene to improve things. I like to have David Hume quotes in most of my talks, and David Hume agrees with me about myopia, and this is no quality of human nature that causes more fatal errors in our conduct than that which leads to further present to the distant and remote. So, how do we meet the John Reed challenge in the end? Well, I've compressed a lot of arguments, but you come to eventually some sort of statement like this: that a deterministic state intervention is justifiable if there is a demonstrable failure of reasoning, if most people do have a failure of reasoning, the majority of individuals affected by the intervention, that we might observe a failure of reasoning. It doesn't necessarily imply automatically that the state should intervene, because the state might not be able to do better. If the state can't do better, so another condition should be that the state can significantly raise the welfare. And here I've assumed that the ends that individuals have as the welfare of those individuals by the intervention. There are relatively few individuals without reasoning failure, and they are likely to be impacted by whatever intervention comes in, and they will presumably lose welfare, lose well-being. Their well-being, assuming that is their end, will not be improved by it. And the impact on autonomy, on individual autonomy of the intervention of both groups is small. We haven't really discussed autonomy. There's an awful lot of it in the book. Autonomy is actually a very difficult concept to grasp. It's, you read the philosophers on it, and the definitions are all over the place. I think most people would agree that the state will be intervening in somebody's autonomy in some way or another. Whether we're talking about people with reasoning failure or people without reasoning failure, there will be an impact on their autonomy, and we want, ideally, for that to be relatively small. Yeah?
There's a deep philosophical issue around this question of smoking, some of the things which relate to the problem of pre-commitment and self-control, which is that you can imagine a situation where a smoker themselves would want to have cigarettes banned so that they can give up. They know they want to give up, and they know that if they're banned, they will give up. They know that if they're not banned, they will carry on smoking because they'll have the odd moments when they're tempted. It's a sense in which whether you should give priority to, if you like, totally free market principle of having cigarettes available all the time, or whether you should give priority to people's own wish to make a commitment. Therefore, if you had a majority of smokers wanting to have cigarettes banned, it could be the case.
Yes. Well, I think that relates to the first bullet point here, which I'm sorry you're going to. There is a demonstrable failure of reason by a majority of individuals affected by the intervention. Well, how do we know there's been a failure of reason? Obviously, that's an imperfect. Finding out whether there have been failures of reason is an imperfect survey. And one of the ways might be looking at what a majority of people actually say they want to do, or engage in pre-commitment, or whether they engage in various activities of various kinds. And in fact, of course, this is quite interesting. It's an interesting point you raise, because something like 70% of smokers do say they want to give up. Also, there's quite an interesting study that looked at the happiness levels of smokers before a price rise, a tax rise in the price of cigarettes, and after the tax rise. And they were happier after the price rise. And the argument being conventionally that they welcomed the fact that they were being more restrictive in that way. Yeah, Martin.
Could it be, in terms of a failure of reasoning, if you were to say, at the age of 18 or older, that I'm not looking forward to old age, past the age of 65, 70, when this kind of starts to affect you, and you think, I'll live life for the now, by that age, there's an uncertain future for me, not much to look forward to, and it's actually a rational choice to enjoy your time and effectively gather the consequences, because I don't see such bright a future that far down the line.
Well, I think the answer is, and I have deliberately avoided terms like rational and irrational precisely for that reason. I mean, yes, I think you could say that having what economists would call a high discount rate and the circumstances is perfectly rational. Again, though, I think you just have to make it. So I'm not trying to make a judgment whether I think that the being myopic is rational or irrational. The only decision I want to make is that the state believes that. It can, by preventing this person smoking or whatever, or in some way impeding their smoking, it can actually raise their lifetime well-being. That's the only requirement. And I mean, I don't think it's a bad judgment in the case of smoking. Actually, I think stopping the 18-year-olds from smoking will raise their lifetime well-being. I'm prepared to argue with John Reed about that. We did eventually get the ban, so it probably plays us through. I think that's a particularly difficult one, the one in terms of rationality and irrationality discussion. Okay, any other queries someone's got at this point? Might be quite a nice point to break.
What about in the case of sort of empire and sort of thinking in terms of wars in Libya and Syria, and thinking about the sort of framework and sort of apprehending the decisions made by states like the United States or nuclear France to act or not act in terms of the reasoning?
What we're saving states from themselves, you mean? Instead of not
state,
saving
state as an individual, perhaps.
The state as an individual. I suppose that's right. I mean, actually, if you look at Tony Blair's liberal interventionist speech in Chicago in 1999, I suppose you have to say it was, yes, fundamentally a paternalistic speech. It was actually saying, yes, we will make judgments that the people in this country have failed to in various ways. Was it ends failure or means failure? It's probably a bit of both, I suspect. And we can raise their lifetime well-being by intervening. Yes, I think that probably is, at the end of the day, something of a paternalistic intervention. Let me go on. Remember, we'll come back to that in a moment. There are different... Now, if we agree that there is likely to be some case for intervention in some circumstances, what's the best way to do it? What's the best way to achieve? Now, there are a variety of different types of intervention. There's the provision of information. I think we agreed earlier that at least I argued earlier that this is as such not, provision of information is such not paternalist. I did mention there might be different paternalistic ways of providing it, and I think the question I throw open to you about whether this really is paternalism. There's a standard finding in health policy analysis that if a doctor is presenting information to a patient about an operation, if the patient is told there is a 5% chance of mortality from this particular operation, they give a very different answer to whether they'll take the operation than if they're told there's a 95% chance of surviving this operation. So the recommendation is we should switch from telling people there's a 5% chance of death from this operation to telling them there's a 95% chance of survival. Is one being paternalist in making that switch? You're clearly, in some sense, you're nudging people to change their decision, change their information, and you're presumably doing it because you think it's in their interest, it's their own good to do it. So I suspect it probably is paternalist. So the provision of information is not an actually neutral thing, but the way it's presented can have paternalist. There is, of course, regulation, and that's the standard. Many paternalistic forms take the form of some form of regulation, wearing seat belts, motorcycle helmets, the banning of illegal drugs of various kinds, and of course the banning of smoking in public places. There's subsidising. We can intervene to subsidise people. There's a lot of interest at the moment in trying to deal with obesity by subsidy, where you subsidise people eat healthy food or to take exercise in various forms. Some of the evidence suggests that in simple cases that can work quite well to actually subsidise. Taxing people, you can tax them, of course, sin taxes. Are we getting near running out of time?
No, I'm just writing a note.
Oh, all right. I thought you had that ominous chairman sign.
No, that's
5 minutes.
Quite the opposite.
Tax. You can tax people, of course, and that's a very common form of trying to deal with many of these areas. Taxes on so-called sin taxes on cigarettes and alcohol and gambling and so on. Or there is so-called libertarian paternalism, nudge, and I just want to conclude by talking a little bit about that. Libertarian paternalism, I think, is an interesting name. I remember trying to convince somebody that it wasn't the Secretary of State this time. It was the permanent secretary, actually, and I was trying to convince them about that there might be some mileage in some of these measures, libertarian paternalist measures, to improve people's health. And he said, well, I don't like libertarians, and I don't like paternalists. Why should I like the two of them together? I think you get the best of both. And the basic idea, and I'm sure many of you have come across this, some of you may have read the book, public institutions might nudge people in directions that will make them lives get better, longer, healthier, and happier, but without actually eliminating their freedom of choice. And the classic examples are, of course, opting in and out. We talked about the pensions example earlier on. Another classic one is organ donation, that you can have a system where you have to carry a card saying that you are prepared to have your organs donated in the event of a fatal accident, or you can have a system by which you have to carry a card saying you are not prepared to have your organs donated in the event of a fatal accident. In those cases, of course, you switch. You change the default, so to speak. The default in one case is that you retain your organs, or your organs are retained. In the other case, your organs are actually extracted for use. So the default is that your organs will be extracted unless you say no. There's some evidence to suggest that switching from one to the other, just as in pension case, does cause big changes in behaviour. It's slightly controversial evidence, but I think it's balanced quite convincing. But they are interesting policies, both of those, both the pensions and the organ, the opt-in, opt-out. organ left in lungs, because you can, it appears, get very big changes in behaviour. You haven't engaged in regulation, you haven't engaged in taxes, you haven't engaged in subsidies, but just a relatively, just by, in some sense, just by changing the default, and you actually got big changes in behaviour. There's another, framing, the way you frame the choices you make, this is a classic. Thaler and Sunstein make a big thing about the placing of healthy food. If you place healthy food at the beginning of a cafeteria line, more people take it than if you place it at the end of the cafeteria line. I don't think they actually present any evidence of this, as a matter of fact, but they do. They use the example several times. And we do know that, for example, in supermarkets placing things at eye level, other things being equal, will encourage purchase of it. And so we could use that. We could place healthy food at eye level. Several countries and several states in the United States use a system of separate alcohol outlets, where you have a slightly sort of grungy place where you go and buy alcohol. And so on, and just generally to sort of nudge people again to frame the decision in such a way that people are discouraged from doing it. This is an idea I got into some trouble with. I might explain about that later. It was an idea about the people to have a permit to smoke, an exercise. That was another of mine, actually. Might go through those again a bit later. But yes.
On framing, where would you classify information provision in the sense that, for example, when you give, for example, like labels for how many calories or how much fattening is like the state trying to avoid obesity or trying to avoid specific result? Would you put that in provision of information or libertarian?
Well, I think, as I indicated before, I don't think the provision of information itself is paternalistic, but the way you frame it, the form you frame it is, could be viewed as paternalistic. For instance, we have, there's quite a lot of evidence now, and we begin to make decisions that, particularly on the labelling of foods, that actually providing people respond better, so to speak, at least from the point of view of the public health. They respond better to traffic light labelling than they do to information about percentage of calories and so on. So I think one probably has to say, yes, it is deterministic to switch from one to the other, because you are trying to change people's behaviour in the direction you think they should go, because you think they'll make a failure. If they're presented with information in a certain way, their judgment will be incorrect. So yes, I think I would agree. Yeah.
Could you explain what marriage default refers to?
I want to get out of here alive.
You're hemmed in.
This came about because looking at the position of cohabiting couples, I do apologise if I'm going to tread on any toes here. Cohabiting couples, when they break up, there's some evidence to suggest that any children they have will be more damaged by the breakup than if they'd been married. And also, and married and broken up, that is. But also, even more importantly, that the partner, well, particularly the woman, falls into poverty much more quickly if there's a cohabiting breakup than if there's a conventional marriage breakup. Because under the marriage they have more rights. The partners have more rights as part of it. So the idea behind the marriage default was that as soon as two people sign the birth certificate of a child, they are regarded as married. At that point, they have the same rights as married couples would have. Now they can do the choice is open to them. They can divorce immediately, if they so wish, but the default, in some sense, the default is marriage, instead of the default being not marriage. I can sure you're immediately thinking of all the problems, like what about people who've got multiple children by different parents? What about the problem? What about gay marriage? And so on. That, perhaps we can talk about that in a little while. Can we just go back to these final justifications? And perhaps I could take you through why I think libertarian determinism is rather a good idea, and how it converts these. Now, I had all those types of intervention that I talked about, tax, subsidy, regulation, and so on. And I think the trick in some ways is to test them against these criteria, how they work. Now, the first two of them, in some sense given, I mean, that depends so much on the case concerned, whatever particular things. So they aren't really particular to the form of intervention, although, of course, well, I suppose that one is, in the sense that you've really got to demonstrate that a libertarian journalistic intervention will raise people's welfare by as much as, say, regulation will, or whatever. But I think these two are the interesting ones. If you take the relatively few individuals without reason failure and loss in welfare, the thing about regulation is that everybody is regulated. So even those who are perfectly well informed about smoking, perfectly well informed about what's going on, are not particularly myopic, they may be quite elderly, and they decide to, but they are all affected by it. And David Hockney will make this point, I'm sure some of you may have heard him on the Today Cracker and elsewhere, he will make this point massively, but it's not just David Hockney, there is a particularly in the smoking case, I said 70% of smokers want to give up, 30% don't. And that's a sizable group. And regulation hits them and creates, at least in David Hockney's terms, a massive loss in welfare. The nice thing about libertarian paternalism, and I'll come to a smoking example of that in a moment, libertarian paternalism is that the choices are still there. People can still make the same choices. It's just that you change the default in the opt-in, opt-out cases. Even in the framing case, the choices are still there. You can still do it. There isn't. Libertarian paternalism really, really rather scores on that line. But actually, people, there'll be lower, there'll be no loss in welfare, or much less loss in welfare for those people without reasoning failure. And this is more controversial, the impact on autonomy is arguably less. You are preserving people's freedom of choice. And some people, indeed Thaler and Sunstein would go on to argue, and you are thereby preserving their autonomy. They have freedom to make these choices. Under the libertarian paternalist regime, they don't under the regulation regime. I think it'd be quite interesting, and I'd be interested to get people's reactions about whether they buy that argument. I buy it, but it could be challenged. Some people would say, well, look, indeed, some authors have said, well, look, what you're doing really is you're exploiting people's psychological foibles, aren't you? I mean, by doing this. You're not trying to correct them. You know, you say they've got reasoning failure. You're not trying to correct their reasoning failure. You're using the fact that they have reasoning failure to achieve your end. In the case of the opting in, opting out, you're using the fact that people are myopic or some sort of notion of inertia or finding it difficult to make decisions, some sort of, or status quo bias, you're using status quo bias and changing the default to exploit that in order to create your result. And isn't this in some sense infringing on their autonomy? Aren't you actually implying, in some sense, they are less than autonomous? I'm not sure I buy that. I mean, I can see that there is a... It is true, I think you are exploiting. I'm not sure whether it really infringes their autonomy, but some people might feel they do. You could... I think I've got some... of course, you could... a related comment to that, to say, well, it isn't transparent what you're doing. When you change the default. If you actually told people, look, we're changing the default on pensions, or organ donation, because we know you're a load of dummies and that you'll just hang on to whatever the status quo is. And this is why we're doing it. Wouldn't people feel a bit pissed off? Wouldn't they feel they've been a bit sort of tricked? I mean, it is true. I mean, I don't know how many of you fly EasyJet or Ryanair, but when you see, when you come to the chunk of it, you might notice a little box that says, do you want insurance or not? And usually that box already got a tick in it. And certainly the first few times I did, I just went straight past that and then ended up paying large sums for insurance I didn't need. Very irritated. And then I went back, and now when I still come across that box, when the menu drops down, I am irritated. And of course, I always untick it out of principle, even if I need insurance, I tick it. So if you do make it, and of course, but you could say, well, in that case, what the government should do is make it transparent. And indeed, Luke Bowden, I don't think he's here, he's argued that. That one could just make it transparent in various ways, but of course, if it did make it transparent, it might stop being effective yet.
Just a quick one. When you say if you make it transparent, it wouldn't be effective, in a sense, if you make it transparent, isn't what you're doing exposing the frame? Mm-hmm. So, when you talk about autonomy, so are we saying that when people are being exposed to sort of positive images around smoking from corporations, they have autonomy. So what you're doing when you deploy a different frame is you're fighting a frame with a frame. But what you do when you're transparent about it is you expose the frame. And that surely is good for choice, genuine choice, rather than a vendor.
Well, I think it was... I don't think it was exposing the frame as such. It's more exposing the motive behind the reason why you've actually changed the frame.
The point is, if you make that motive explicit, then people will recognise.
They might be more sympathetic to it.
So if you give one frame or the other, the point is people don't see it. But if you put two contrasting or sort of contradictory frames alongside each other, that exposes.
Well, yes. Some people would argue that actually the way to do it is to have false choice. And in fact, it does happen, I think. Has anyone taken out a UK driving licence recently? But I think on the form for the UK driving licence, you have to tick a box saying you will, one box saying you will have your orders donated, another one saying you will not. So you have false choice, which is making it hopefully very explicit. That might be the answer to some of the problems. Yeah.
You can't choose if you don't know that you have a choice to make. And the opt-in, opt-out is, it takes away the ability to, and I'm not saying it's positive or negative, but people don't realise that they're making a choice enough or that a choice has already been made for them.
Well, I think that, ideally, the people who advocate this kind of thing would say, yes, they would know there's a choice. And in other words, if you're opted in automatically into a pension, you get a letter when you take up your employment or whatever the pension scheme is, that says, this is the pension scheme. You're automatically enrolled in it. If you don't wish to participate in it, you'll have to write this letter to make sure that...
If you're operating under status quo bias, or if you're operating under all of those biases, you're just going merrily along your way. You don't realise that you're losing a choice in that.
Well, indeed there is a Rubinato, who's written a book on all of this, has argued that quite strongly, that the freedom of choice is in some sense an illusion. And the very fact that that people have these psychological foibles indicates the freedom of choice is an illusion. I don't wholly buy that. I mean, because actually, in these opt-in, opt-out cases, people do opt out. Some people do opt out. Some do. I mean, not a majority or a proportion do opt out. I think I'm just trying to think of examples. In Sweden, I think in an opt-in, opt-out organ donation one, I think 80% stay in and 20% opt out. The fact that anybody opts out indicates that there is real freedom of choice going on there, because the fact is that some people actually do it.
But surely, as long as people behave the same in both cases.
Sorry?
Surely it's only the individuals who make the same choice invariant to how it's presented to me, and the others aren't.
I think that's right. What's the significance of that?
So you're saying some people do opt in, some people do opt out, so there is a choice. But the point is, you have a bunch of different individuals, some of whom may be making choices, some of whom aren't. And we can assume the people that make the same choice, regardless of how it's presented, are making a choice. But the people who make a different choice than how it's presented, are they making a choice? Surely that's the whole point.
Well, so that implies the freedom of choice is illusory for those who don't make the choice? Is that the argument? I wouldn't argue that. I mean, I think the choices are there, whether you like them or not. And if people's psychological foibles are such that they don't take advantage of them or whatever, the choice is open, then I don't think that violates the fact that the choices are there. Yeah?
You briefly said something about a mandated choice, essentially. So, in the ordinated...
False choice, yes, mandated choice.
In the ordinated choice, yeah. Instead of having a status quo, you have to choose between... Yeah. Either opt in or opt out. Do you think that sort of is the resolution to these questions about problems of autonomy? And in general, do you think that if that's not a satisfactory, I guess, option, what does that mean, I guess, about the costs, I guess, that we're imposing on individuals for, yes?
Well, I think it reduces our worries about autonomy in the sense that it is clear, I mean, the point, but the phrase is being transparent, is there very transparently, and you've got to make the decision and you've got to make the choice. So it's a very conscious, overt way of doing things. The trouble is, of course, that it's probably not as effective as if you didn't have it quite so.
So then my question is, does it follow that you can legitimately say that you're respecting autonomy because when you provide this choice, which is, I think, probably most like alternative choice you can have here when you say mandated choice, and it leads to less desirable outcomes, I guess. Are you then respecting autonomy?
Well, you're trading off autonomy against well-being, aren't you? I mean, at the end of the day, you say, and I suspect your answer will probably depend on the size of the trade-off. I mean, if you're restricting people's autonomy only a tiny bit, and you get a massive increase in well-being, as indeed, for example, you might ask in the case of compelling people to wear seatbelts, or indeed motorcycle helmets, you'll probably go for the restriction or the intervention or the libertarian-terminist version or whatever. If on the other hand the intervention autonomy is really quite significant, whereas the increase in well-being is not, is positive, but maybe not as great as it otherwise might be, then you would go for the, you tailor your intervention appropriately. I suppose, what do I think about the forced choice in the organ donation one? I think I would prefer a system, an opt-out system, not a forced choice. Because I think the increase in well-being would be so great that even though I would accept that I think there's a greater degree of autonomy intervention by the opt-out system than by the forced choice. But that depends on my values and how I trade these things off. Let me just finish on permit to smoke, because I had some fun with this. The idea was, I was trying to think about, and I think one of the real problems of libertarian paternalism is trying to think about the purchase of the idea, or trying to think of various ways of doing it. Can one think of opt-in and opt-out in most of these cases, particularly in the public health case, in the health cases? But I thought, well, maybe we would have a system where, at the moment, the default for smoking is the use of, that you have to make a decision not to be a smoker. If you already are a smoker. Here the decision, suppose you have a smoking permit, so people have to make a decision every year to opt in to being a smoker. They have to go down to the post office, they have to buy a permit, they have to fill out a form. The form could be a little complex. Governments are good at that. A little tricky, a bit of a form. And they have to supply ID, that would be a useful byproduct of it, so you can check on people's age. about to fill out a form. I did think maybe they should also have to get a doctor's signature, but I thought I didn't think we could probably wear that one, and I didn't think the doctors would do it either. And you have to get this permit, and then you present the permit every time you want to buy tobacco. Just as indeed if you want to, if you're underage or whatever, you have to present a permit to buy alcohol, or some proof of age or whatever. So every year you have to opt in to being a smoker. And I think the welfare gains might be considerable. But the impact on autonomy is fairly minimal. I mean, there is an impact on autonomy, you are. But it's not, but you can do it, you can be a smoker. You can be one. I mean, it's not very difficult. It's a little bit difficult, but it's not very difficult to be a smoker. So you can, so the impact on autonomy is fairly small. And I think there's some evidence of indirect evidence. Nobody actually has a permit to smoke, that it could stop people actually starting to smoke. They wouldn't actually get there because they know that they'd have to go and get this permit. Of course, you're probably in your heads already thinking of all the problems. I mean, enforcement is a clear problem. I mean, why don't you just somebody else go and get your cigarette? Somebody's got a permit for you. And of course, there's smuggling issues. I mean, already I think something like half the tobacco, the loose tobacco smoked in the UK is smuggled in already. And is the autonomy impact really small? Well, it's clearly a lot of people didn't think that. So it's the only occasion I've really been monstered by the tabloids. They had a lot of fun with this one. Sorry?
They're both from the Daily Mail.
I think one's the Daily Express. One's the Daily Express. And that was the Independent. They were calmer. And then it got picked up. It got picked up by the Drudge Report in the United States. I don't know how many of you know that's a blog in the United States. And my email inbox exploded, mostly with pictures of Hitler. I've got a lot of pictures of Hitler. I was quite good on Franco, Mao Zedong, Stalin. And this is some of the comments I got. I don't know how many of you can read these. I have to say, the first one said these people are leftovers from the regimes of Mao, Stalin, Mussolini, and Hitler. Any asset we feel they don't want control over, we should all be frightened, very frightened. I have to say that two of those are actually rather complimentary or rather favourable, unless they're being sarcastic. I'm not quite sure. Whereas two are against. I fear that is not representative. It was 99% against, but I couldn't bring myself to put up all 99%. But anyway, so it has to be said that you don't, that in dealing with these kind of issues, you are treading on thin ice. There are people who clearly do regard libertarian paternalism as as certainly paternalistic and not at all libertarian. So, on that note, I'll stop and open to further discussion.
Right, okay, well, we've started questions and answers anyway. So, would anybody like to? Sure, there are plenty of questions. I will try to keep these perhaps in groups of three. Okay, one, two, and one back, three.
Hi, I had a question about, as a policymaker, you're being led to a decision about whether you want to go down the regulatory route or maybe use the legal paternalism. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that with regulation there's the benefit, the symbolic benefit that comes with saying, as a society, we stand against this type of thing, so if you're driving, wearing a seatbelt, it feels like that has an added benefit, which is that, you know, you can bring about a step change in behaviour, whereas going down this route is more subtle, maybe you lose that symbolism. So is there a difficult decision-making point there for policymakers in terms of the gravity of the issue and how important it's considered and the type of message that you want to put out?
No, it's okay.
Okay, I see. I was wrong. Do it, yes, because they'll all be different. Unless anybody has a very closely related question to that one.
I think simply to acknowledge the point. I mean, I agree with you. I think that it is one of the advantages of regulation. Is that it has a clear demonstration effect. Society disapproves of this. And I'm sure that, and I also think, and it's related a bit to our criteria, that regulation can work when it goes with the grain of what people want to do anyway. I'm sure one of the value for making public places has been more successful than I must say I expected, or I think that many people have been expected. But it probably was because it was actually going with the grain of what people wanted to do. It was what people thought they ought to be doing, and the fact that the state endorsed this was important. So yes, I agree. And the libertarian terminus really doesn't quite have that. Although I suppose the forced choice might. The forced choice, it does, it brings up the organ donation on the driving licence, and it does bring the fact to people's attention, so it does have something of a demonstration effect, actually. I did think, another of my ideas was for a voluntary taxation, on the tax form that you fill out, there will be a little box, and next to the box would be saying that there could be an extra 1% of your tax, and this will go to, I don't know, some cause that you might like. A selection of causes, poverty relief or whatever. And there's a little box you could tick to indicate that if you did not want your work to pay this extra 1% of tax, and then the tax return would be published. So I thought it would be quite a good demonstration effect. And it would get at all my dinner party colleagues who keep saying they believe in redistribution, they believe in helping the poor, but the government should tax them to make sure they do it. They're quite brutal to it themselves.
And maybe you've got another of those nows in the headlines in the papers for that, I suspect.
Oh, yes.
Now, he's going to tax us without us knowing it.
That's right.
Then blue. And then
Deborah.
Yeah, I was just struck by the way that framing the question around paternalism means that the debate focuses on whether the measure impinges on people's autonomy or not. But, you know, in your definition of paternalism, a very important part of it was what are the intentions of the state in conducting the measure. And I thought that actually does open up a bit of a can of worms, doesn't it? I mean, the state actually generally doesn't have just one coherent intention. There's a lot of ambiguity about intentions. If you look at something like the defaulting into pensions, you could say, well, it's framed as making people better off, but its intentions are a lot to do with fixing up other parts of the pension system and reducing liabilities on the public purse in future years. So how does that part of the story come into your
mind? Well, I am... as somebody pointed out, I've got a sort of basically unified, benevolent view of the state here. That's what you mean. The state is a benevolent paternalist. Not a dictator, but a benevolent paternalist. Of course, I mean, part of my conditions were, can the state do better? But there is indeed an additional question, will the state do better? Doesn't the state have its own agenda? Many states have their own agenda. When they use this as a kind of a cover for doing the things they want to do anyway, or different kinds of things. I mean, I think all I can do is put my hand up and say, yes, I am. I'm not one of those people who thinks that every politician is venal, and that everything the state does is designed to, e.g., maximise votes or maximise the budget or whatever. I think the state can act in the interests of its citizens. I think it probably often does act in the interests of its citizens, to be a little more definite. So I don't think that assumption is wholly misplaced or unified. So I've been involved in a lot of these kind of discussions actually at the state. And the banning smoking in public places is one more interesting because none of the interest groups were in favour of it. The powerful interest groups, and obviously not the tobacco companies, have powerful say in, but the hospitality industry, which is also quite powerful in the corridors of Whitehall, they were deeply opposed to it. They kept saying, and people like Camra and a whole range of the more liberal pressure groups were also deeply opposed to it. In fact, there wasn't anybody really. I don't think even the BMA came out in favour of it. There wasn't really anybody in favour of it except us, really. It was all sitting in government. So I do think that government can at times get it right, but I acknowledge that I am making an assumption.
Could I just pick on that? I mean, there are some things that the government would then decide it was going to use this, with your encouragement, to use the nudge type approach in order to achieve an end. Now, would it prioritise those by researching which nudge type interventions might work and then just use them? Or would it have some slightly more sophisticated way of deciding how to do it? And then, I mean, presumably government would decide between using nudge and the regulation, requirement by law. Because there are some things the government requires us to do the like by law, like jury service. Other things it would use nudge for, like the blood donation. So, I mean, the government would have to have some sort of framework of decision making, would it, in order to know which to use when, or would it just use the nudge interventions that worked?
I suspect that when it does, in a crude way, it probably goes through these kind of criteria that I listed in my final justification. For example, I expect it tries to work out, well, if you have a regulation, not the exact step, I think I can probably say it does, if you've got a regulation, how many people are going to be adversely affected, who should not be adversely affected? How many people, for example, people who are not suffering from reasoning failure, with respect to smoking or something else, how many people are going to be adversely affected by this? And if they think there are a lot of them, then they're not inclined to go down the regulatory route. And they desperately search around trying to find some other way of doing it. And hence they do go, and that's when nudge ideas become
very effective. It looks like almost a measure of political weakness or lack of will. The government will only intervene where it feels it can get some purchase without losing votes, and then it sounds a bit sort of reflection of political weakness.
Well, you could phrase it like that. You could phrase it as the government is respecting the rights of minorities. And indeed, as indeed it should do.
Okay. Right, so chap at the back, and then the door, yeah. And then we'll come
over. So in your definition of what's determinism, you suggested that failure has to be judged by the state, and that it has to be in the person's good. I'm not certain if that's necessarily right. So the track the economists are on, which I think is actually suits very well with what's going on with the psychologists, is the idea the way that we can judge whether people are having a failure is when there's inconsistencies in choice. And there's very, very many ways that we can get inconsistencies. So if you look at Kahneman's original experiments, and you talk about the flip between 95% success, 5% failure, that's based around the fact that we see this, we see something that we know is completely neutral, and yet we see a change in choice. There's many ways that we can get inconsistencies. You talk about state and preferences, for example, versus choice. You look at choices over time. All these things, you can potentially use those to build up evidence of... So I'd say, potentially you could put those together. You'd say failure of people as judged by themselves, and then you need some kind of theory as to whether they're making mistakes, and whether indeed the mistake is worth intervening or not. Now, there's some very tricky issues there. Have you had a mutual frame? Have you determined these things? But isn't that an alternative?
Fair enough, and indeed my co-author and I had several discussions about this, and he argued quite strongly that the fact that it was one of the distinctions between ends failure and means failure, we couldn't think of any evidence. I don't know what form the evidence would take to say that there's ends failure. However, there is quite a lot of evidence coming from behavioural economics that there is means failure, that people do make mistakes. And there are inconsistencies and so on and so on. But I think the problem is, from the state's point of view, is, and it's a problem I think for behavioural economics generally, is how important are these mistakes? Most of the experiments are comprised of Harvard or MIT undergraduates and involve receiving or not receiving coffee cups. I exaggerate. Does this really tell us?
So you could take potentially argue payment protection insurance, a large part of that is a mistake, for example, that's...
That's true. And the fact that pensions, the fact there's a big change in pensions behaviour by the change of default indicates that something, there is something going on. So, yes. Well, I think, again, the state has to, it is benevolent, the state has to make a judgment. Is this particular inconsistency or this particular error of reasoning failure a large one and therefore worthy of consideration and intervention? I think the worry I have in relation to the point that George raised, myopia. We know there's hyperbolic discounting, but here what I'm referring to is actually it's ordinary discounting. I'm just simply saying it's very difficult to put yourself at 18 in the role as an engaged role, and there might be perfectly rational reasons, quote unquote, for discounting or not. And there I think it's more difficult to observe inconsistencies, although type of discounting is still one.
Okay, just in the doorway and then the woman in the corner there. Yeah.
Just a quick point on this question.
Well, make them both quick if you can, so we'll get through lots more.
Which is that actually sort of inconsistency is a bit of a hard argument to make, because you can easily respond that, well, sort of, you know, markets give people what they want when they want it at the time, you know. But what I was wanting to make was a point around choice of instruments in policy, and say that it's very clear that it really isn't a sort of either or situation. You know, sort of going back to the smoking stuff, imagine investing public money in sort of associating sort of negative things with smoking without banning advertising by tobacco companies, you know, that would be a bit of a bad, you know, policy mix of instruments. And as a sort of policy designer.
Yes, actually, I meant to comment because you actually mentioned the you mentioned something like this before, where you pointed out that the we are operating, of course, in a world where there are lots of nudges going on, and the nudges undertaken by commercial firms of one kind or another. And one of the justifications for the state intervening at all, but particularly, of course, a nudge intervention, is simply pushing back all these nudges that are going on. And indeed, they certainly are. And I had, again, quite a lot of experience at number 10 of the lobbying power. And sometimes quite more effective lobbying power than one might think. I remember getting taken out to lunch by Cadbury's. It was quite a good lunch, I have to say. I declared it on the register. But they said, what we were talking about was traffic light labelling of foods, and I was trying to encourage traffic light labelling of foods. And they said, look, I said, the trouble is every chocolate bar will be red. I think. And I said, well, yes. couldn't you reduce the fat and sugar content of your chocolate bars? And they said, look, chocolate bars are fat and sugar. and they said, it is really ironic, because we were set up by the Quakers. Indeed, most of the chocolate firms were actually set up by the Quakers in one form or another. And we were set up to curb the demon drink. And now we're the ones being demonised. And I have elements of sympathy in that. We didn't get traffic light labelling through, I have to say. One of the problems with that, it turned out to be a European Union level decision, not a national decision, because it affects the internal market. But your general point there, there is a general point there, that there are an awful lot of nudges going on, and that part of the justification of this process is to nudge back.
I'm in the corner there, and then here, and then there. So right in the corner.
Oh, right, Tim, yeah, hi.
So far, most of the interventions that you have been discussing are about NUDGE so far has helped a lot with the implementation of policies that are not to sound like that. I wonder how NUDGE may form decisions or debates about removing some bad samples. For instance, what's the take of NUDGE on legalizing marijuana, for instance? ban of drinking for in the US, for example. So how can that, do the same rules apply when you are becoming more liberal in what you're offering to? So you're offering a choice of smoking marijuana to the population. How can you use these?
Well, I think I agree. To reiterate the point I made earlier, that I do think one of the problems with the nudge thing is trying to think of, particularly in the health arena, is actually trying to think of suitable nudge policies. But the smoking permit, in a way, is the way probably I would deal with the marijuana case. I would say, yes, marijuana ought to be legal, but there ought to be a permit. In fact, oddly enough, that's the way that heroin used to be dealt with. We used to have a system before heroin was made actually legal. There was a system of registered heroin users. And in a way, the smoking permit is the idea of registered smokers, registered addicts, we're talking about here. And registered addicts, registered heroin users, and could get heroin administered by the National Health Service or whatever health service it is. So in a way, the sort of the smoking the permit idea are a way of trying to deal with that. But I think it is, in general, quite difficult, actually, to spread the libertarianist ideas very far.
Okay, gentleman in the front row.
I'm interested in some of the equity implications of what you're saying. Even Josh, you're really struggled a bit here, the position of the worst off. I think you tussled with John Reed about this in relation to people who live in prisons or in mental health institutions and questions about whether autonomy was central to rehabilitation or recovery, whether mental health users, for example, smoke because it's an appetite suppressant and drugs lead them to put on weight, and so on. So aren't there some issues about who the minorities are or the people for whom it is a perfectly sensible choice, which your model does not completely encompass at the moment?
No. I agree, the model doesn't deal with it explicitly, you're quite right. I suppose that the way you would a proper analysis of this, when you look, say, at the welfare losses and gains from the intervention, would look at the distribution of those welfare losses and gains, as part, and that would be part of the decision as to whether. And of course, as you're quite right, John Reed also said, he's actually quoted as saying that the working class have few pleasures, and so few problems, and you're depriving them of that by these kind of measures. I would concede that I think you shouldn't only look at the absolute levels of welfare gains and also the distribution.
Martin, and then.
Yeah. All right.
I wanted to know a bit more about the limitations of all this. All of this strikes me as only individuals. But if I was now to just say all public policy problems are about organisations, not individuals, or the big ones, what is that then the fundamental challenge? Because I have an assumption, when nudge comes from, I guess, about the motivations, the capacity of individuals. I cannot assume the same organisations. So is that then where all this comes to a stop? And the second question I have is about, these seem to me all sort of pretty straightforward issues about founded rationality and so on, but where Deborah's question I think came from a little bit also, but maybe I misunderstood her too, was where is it when we have, not necessarily the state is evil or not evil, but where the state has to do value choices between fairness, efficiency, robustness and so on, and to what extent can nudge basically hide away from these ultimate value conflicts which any intervention takes place? You can say there's efficiency, but let's assume now there's a trade-off between having to have a nudge which makes society fairer or more efficient or more robust in some way or another, add slack to the system. What decision rules does that apply under libertarian paternalism?
Well, I think the first question, could this apply to organisations? I was challenged, but I spent a period in Brussels and was a nominal advisor to the European Commission, to the President of the European Commission. And and we talked quite a lot about nudge ideas just a minute. Well, is there any way we can use nudge techniques when we're dealing with the 27th of the member states? Is there some way we can automatically enroll them in something and then they have to, and then the political inertia we may go, okay. In principle, I don't see why not. I mean, many of these foibles, many of these political, one of these problems probably apply as much to organisations as they do, well, maybe not as much, they apply to individuals as well. A related topic to that, though, it is true that this is a very individualistic way of looking at things. You are trying to change individual behaviour. And some people do object to it by saying you should be going after tobacco companies. You shouldn't be wasting your time with all this stuff. You shouldn't be going after tobacco. So we live in a world of organisations. I thought that's what you're getting at, but I think you will. But that's my responsibility, though. What was your second question?
Sort of inherent value trade-off.
Value trade-off. Well, I suppose, I mean, I do believe that, an awful lot of public policy is about trade-off between values. And an awful lot of the problems that people often have with public policy is that they think that values are incommensurate, or at least cannot be trade-off against one another. That equality trumps everything else, or liberty trumps everything else, or efficiency trumps everything else. I believe in trade-offs, that there are trades to be made. And as I was pointing out in the case of libertarian paternalism, one of the things that attracts me about it is that I think any paternalistic invention involves a trade-off between well-being and autonomy. I find it very difficult to think of one that didn't involve some trade-off. The nice thing about the libertarian paternalist intervention is that it seems to me that the impact of autonomy is relatively small. And so we can get the well-being gains without having to trade off too much by the way of autonomy. As we saw, some people would disagree. So the trade-off issue is very much there.
In the second row here, and then front row here.
Touched on before, but your justification does rest particularly on ex-ante policy analysis being good, being accurate. So, in other words, the state can know whether it's going to raise the welfare of people, and we can be confident in that. But obviously, firstly, policymakers, and sadly even the policymaking process, are subject to over-optimism bias, confirmation bias, as you know from your experience. And secondly, human behaviour is complex and frequently in complex environment. So you may think from the problems you conceptualise that you're worried about someone's welfare, but you may not be aware that there are spillover effects because somebody's prevented from doing one thing. They may, for example, if they can't buy drugs, they own a burglar house. Exactly. So doesn't this point towards rather flexibility in policy making so you can adapt to how people are behaving as a result rather than being rigid and applying it?
Well, I think it does, I don't think, I think libertarian paternalism is rather flexible. That's what I quite like about it, actually. For example, you delete that box off the...
Libertarian paternalism, maybe, but the policy-making process isn't so much, and that's the way libertarian paternalism is delivered right now. So I think that's quite an important point.
Well, I suppose so, but that's true of any. I mean, that's a really nihilistic attitude towards policy. Isn't it? We can't do perfect policy. We can't. If we got an imperfect policy, we can't change it. Therefore, we shouldn't do any policy. We shouldn't make any policy. I don't think I'd buy that.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, in terms of libertarian, I mean, your justification, makes sense on its own terms. But if there is a lot of complexity going on about how you judge exactly what the welfare benefits will be to somebody, it's about how you conceptualise the problem in terms of the policy problem.
But that would be true of any paternalistic intervention. And so I don't think that's particular to libertarian paternalism. I mean, we've got to make that judgment about well-being gains and all the rest of it from the interventions.
Yeah, and maybe critiques of paternalist intervention there.
It's all.
Itching at the back to join in. Very briefly.
I think I get where Michael's going at a little bit, and it relates to some of this stuff. So if you look at Ben Leighton and the work he's doing, I was talking about how the economist framing things up. So this idea of you've got to build up evidence in order to know where the choices are good or bad. I think where Michael was coming from to ask is you've got to do experiments in order to try and figure out what works. Is that largely where you're heading at, Michael?
Yeah, I'll
take it. So if you look at how the later and how the radical stuff on pensions, they're in fact exactly using experiments in order to understand what is good or bad. So it's a far more, flexible policy framework in order to be able to move forward.
Well, I suppose more generally, not just experiments, but getting evidence of all kinds will make the policy more flexible. And it doesn't, yes, I see what you mean. You don't want a system that is too dependent upon different conceptual constructions, because that's too easy to change. The policy may get changed on the wing, in a sense, by different concepts coming through. What you want is solid evidence for your thing, and I would basically agree with that.
Okay, we'll take one final question from the front here. Then
yeah, good. Everyone's mentioned smoking. I want to hear more about this marriage by fiat. Please explain the story behind that. That sounds absolutely fascinating.
Well, I think I did. The marriage before idea about cohabitation.
Did anybody support that? I mean, I can't imagine. I don't mean that in a crisp way, but I'm genuinely, that's fascinating. Who
do
you get to go along with that?
this is the idea I came up with. I put it in an article. It was after I was out of government. It wasn't anybody was doing it in government. Did anybody support? I got one or two letters of support, I think, particularly from feminist groups, because they saw it as a way of... I mean, there's a widespread belief there's something called common law marriage, and it doesn't exist. And many women are convinced that they're cohabiting, they have certain rights over the property and pensions and everything else, which they don't have. And the nice thing about this idea was that it gave them those rights. So the people who supported that felt it was a good idea.
It didn't get any
traction in the policy world.
What about the evidence about dissolution of cohabiting relationships being more traumatic than divorces? I was just having a look on case study. I couldn't find it. Where did that come from?
I haven't got the evidence to hand, but I can dig it out.
Bombay office out.
Okay, I think we're coming up to 7:30. Just listening to this excellent discussion and questioning and scepticism and enthusiasm at the edge of how government acts for the best of its citizens and how it makes decisions about how it does that. I was struck, I went to a seminar in the Treasury a few years ago with the then head of the Cabinet Secretary, I think George might have been there. He put up two posters. One was a wartime poster, early in the Second World War, sort of early 40s, and it had a picture of two rosy-cheeked children, and it had the caption, "Leave them in the countryside, they're safer there." This was trying to ensure parents to leave their children where they'd been evacuated to the countryside because they'd be safe. And the second one was a contemporary poster which simply had some sticked children, and it said, "Do you want to be happy?" And this was an anti-obesity campaign, but the government didn't want to address it too directly for fear that it being the government's message, people would be put off. So you can see the way in which government now has to approach the public differently than it would have done 50, 60, 70 years ago. Anyway, Julian, great evening. Thank you very much for speaking to us and taking all these questions. So, yeah.